bite of her food and drank a whole bottle of wine and walked home to her bungalow in bare feet over the sand. The only day she had in the sun, she wore her white bikini that bagged on her because she'd lost so much weight. The waiters saw the tears sliding out from under her sunglasses and brought her cold glasses of fruit juice without being asked. She burned and stayed in the sun until the skin on her shoulders was blistered. The next morning, she awoke to an elephant in the window, slowly carrying a little girl up the beach, led by the halter by a slender young woman in a sarong. In the night, the anger had struck at the sadness and chased it off. Mathilde's body ached with yesterday's sun. She sat up and saw her face in the mirror opposite the bed, red and lightning sharp, and already resolved. Here was the Mathilde she'd grown so accustomed to, the one who had never not fought. Hers was a quiet, subtle warfare, but she had always been a warrior. That poetess was imaginary, she had to tell herself. That skinny musician named Leo had nothing on her because he was a boy and he was powerless. Of course she'd prevail. How dare she walk away? 2 days after she arrived, her plane lifted off the ground and she was in the air again. She had spent 6 days molten on the inside. They handed God to her at the kennel, and the dog was so happy to see her she tried to nose her way into Mathilde's torso. Mathilde came home to the frigid house, stinking of the garbage she hadn't bothered to take out before she left. She put her suitcase in the closet upstairs to deal with later, and sat down at the kitchen table with a cup of tea to strategize. The problem wasn't what she would do to go fetch Lotto back to her. It was what she wouldn't do. There were too many choices. There was too much possibility. In a few moments, she heard a car on the drive. On the gravel came a step with a hitch in it. Her husband came in the door. She let him wait. Then she looked at him across the great distance. He was thinner, finer than when he left, as if whittled. On his face, there was something she dropped her eyes to keep from seeing. He sniffed the air, and to prevent him from speaking about the smell of garbage and the coldness of the house, which would have broken something, would have made it impossible to return to him, she crossed the kitchen and locked his mouth to hers. The taste, after so long, was strange, the texture rubbery, a shock of unfamiliarity. There was a slight shifting in him, a sense of bending. He was about to speak, but she pushed her hand hard against his mouth. She would have shoved her hand inside him if she could to keep the words from coming out. He understood. He smiled, dropped his bag, walked her backward into the wall, his great body on hers, the dog whimpering at his feet. She took her husband ferociously by the hips and pulled him ahead of her through the hall and up the stairs. She pushed him with all she had, and he landed very hard on the bed, hissing at residual pain in his bad left side. He looked up at her, a puzzlement moving on his face, and again he tried to talk, but she now cupped his mouth and shook her head and took off her shoes and pants, unbuttoned his shirt, his pants. Oh, those boxer briefs with the hole along the elastic, they broke her heart. His ribs were visible in his pale chest. His was a body having undergone terrific strain. She took 4 of his ties from the closet, remnants of his prep school boyhood, rarely worn now in his life. He laughed when she tied his wrists to the bed frame, though she felt sickly inside. Deadly. She knotted another tie into a blindfold. He made a strange noise, but she tied the 4th as a gag and pulled it unnecessarily tight, the blue of the silk digging into his cheeks. For a long time, she crouched above him, feeling powerful. She left her shirt on to hide her sunburn, the peeling skin. Her face, she'd explain, by a long bike ride. She brushed the tip of him with her pelvis, gently, and at random. He started with every touch. He'd been reduced to this long body, so expectant, the eyes removed, the tongue removed. When he was panting behind his gag, she dropped onto him hard, not caring if it hurt him. She thought of, what? Scissors in fabric. It had been so long. It was so unfamiliar. The taut belly below her like the crisp top of creme brulee. His face was red under the restraint. He was mouthing his fish mouth as if to free it, and she dug her fingernails into his waist, bringing up crescents of blood. His back arched off the mattress, the veins in his neck raised, blue. He came before she did, and so she wouldn't. It didn't matter. She'd groped toward something in the dark and had somehow seized it back to her. She thought of the words she'd kept him from speaking, building up, mounting in him until there was unbearable pressure. And though she took the blindfold off, she left the gag, kissing his purple wrists. The way he looked at her now, with the silk darkened in an egg shape by spit, was quizzical. She leaned over and kissed him between the eyebrows. He held her loosely by the waist, and she waited until she knew he wasn't going to say anything about what he had gone through, and then untied the last tie on his mouth. He sat up and kissed the pulse under her chin. His warmth, she had missed it so. His body's palette of stinks. He respected the silence. He rose and went to the bathroom to take a shower, and she went downstairs to boil some pasta. Puttanesca. She couldn't resist the dig. When he came down, he showed her the cuts she'd raised on his sides.
"Wildcat woman," he said,
and there was a little sadness in the way he watched her now. This should have been the end. This was not the end. She kept a Google search on Leo Sen. When, the week before Christmas, the terrible news of the boys drowning in the cold ocean rose on the screen, she'd felt startled. And then victory, hot and terrible, rose in her chest. She looked away from her own face in the reflection of the computer screen. When Lotto was upstairs, buried in his new play, she went to Stewart's and bought a newspaper. She saved it until the morning of Christmas Eve and put it at the mirror near the front door, where, she knew, Lotto would wait for Rachel and her wife and the children. He loved the holidays, as they matched the hot and jolly center of himself. He would be staring out the window to the country road impatiently and wouldn't fail to see the paper. He would know then what it was that she knew. She heard him whistling and came out of the bedroom at the top of the stairs to watch. He smiled at himself in the mirror, checked his profile, and his hand fell on the paper. He looked more closely and began to read. He went pale, clutched the table beneath him as if he would faint. Rachel and Elizabeth were bickering when the back door opened and they came into the kitchen, and the children were shrieking with excitement, and the dog was screaming with happiness at the prospect of them. She'd saved the paper for right now, because with company, he wouldn't argue, he wouldn't make things worse by saying them aloud, and if he didn't say them immediately, he wouldn't say them at all. Lotto looked up into the mirror and saw Mathilde on the stairs behind him. She looked at him, looking at her. A new understanding came into his face, and then vanished. He was frightened by this glimpse of what was in her, and wouldn't watch it unfurl. She took a step down the stairs.
"Merry Christmas!" she called out. She was clean, pine-scented. She descended. She was a child. She was as light as air.
"Welsch Dunkel hier," sings Florestan in Beethoven's Fidelio, an opera about a marriage. Most operas, it is true, are about marriage. Few marriages could be called operatic. "What darkness here," is what Florestan sings. New Year's Day was the only day in her life she believed in a god. Ha! Rachel and Elizabeth and the children still asleep upstairs in the guest room. Mathilde made scones, a frittata, her life a long and endless round of entertaining. She turned on the television. Turmoil in black and gold, a fire in the night, a shot of bodies under sheets, neat as tents on a plane. A building with arched windows, blackened and unroofed. Someone's cell phone video just before the conflagration, a band on a stage shouting a countdown to the new year, sparklers spitting out fire, laughing faces. Now, outside, and people being helped to ambulances, lying on the ground, devastated skin, charred and pink. The thought of meat, inescapable. Mathilde felt a slow sickness overcome her. This place she recognized. She had been there just nights before. The press of bodies at the locked doors, the choking smoke, the screams. That juicy girl next to that big American man on the bar stool. The bartender with the lush eyelashes, the shock of her cold hand on Mathilde's skin. When she heard Rachel's step on the top stair, she turned off the television, went quickly out into the backyard with God to compose herself in the cold. That evening over dinner, Rachel and Elizabeth announced that Elizabeth was pregnant. In bed, when Mathilde wept and wept, in gratitude and guilt and horror for all that she had escaped, Lotto thought it was because his sister was so rich with children and they were so terribly, unfairly poor. Later, he cried too, into her hair, and the distance between them was bridged, and they were again united. 8. The airport deafened. Aurélie, 11, alone, understood nothing. At last she saw the man holding the sign with her name on it, and knew with a rush of relief that this must be her uncle, the much older brother of her mother. The child, the grandmother always said, of her wicked youth, though her old age was wicked as well. The man was jolly, round, red, full of sympathy. Already she liked him.
"No, mademoiselle," he said. "Non oncle. The driver."
She didn't understand, so he pantomimed driving a car. She swallowed her disappointment.
"No parlez français," the driver said. "Except voulez-vous coucher avec moi?"
She blinked hard, and he said,
"No, no, 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 no. No vous. Excusez-moi. No voulez coucher avec vous."
He flushed redder and chuckled all the way to the car. He stopped off the highway to buy her a strawberry milkshake. It cloyed and made her stomach hurt, but she drank it all because it was kind of him. She was frightened of spilling on the leather seats and held the cup carefully all the way to her uncle's house. They stopped on a gravel drive. The house was a modest place for a man with a driver. Stern old Pennsylvania Dutch farmhouse of impenetrable stone and ancient windows so bubbled they played tricks with the landscape beyond. The driver carried her bag up to her room, which alone was twice the size of her grandmother's Paris apartment. In one wall was her own marble bathroom, with a green shower mat of such thickness it was like new spring grass in the park. She wanted to lie down on it immediately and sleep for days. In the kitchen, the driver pulled out of the refrigerator a plate with a pale chicken cutlet, potato salad, beans, and a note her uncle had written in French about how he would meet her when he got home. Television, he counseled, was the best way to learn English. Do not leave the house. Make a list of the things she needed, and the driver would see to it that she got them tomorrow. It was hard for her to overlook how many mistakes he made with his spelling. The driver showed her how to lock the door and put on the alarm. He wore a worried look on his flabby face, but he had to go. She ate very close to the television, warming herself against its staticky screen, watching some incomprehensible show about leopards. She washed everything and put it all back where she thought it belonged and tiptoed upstairs. She tried every door, but every one but hers was locked, then washed her hands and face and feet, brushed her teeth, and climbed into the bed. But it was too large, and the room too full of shadows. She brought the duvet and a pillow into the empty closet and fell asleep on the carpet that smelled like dust. In the thick of the night, she woke suddenly to find a thin man peering down at her from the doorway. Something about his large eyes and apple cheeks brought back her grandmother. He had ears like small, pale bat wings. His face brought her mother's, through the smoke of years, to her.
"So," he said in French, "the devil girl."
He seemed amused, though he wasn't smiling. She felt her breath twist. From the first, she understood he was very dangerous, despite his mild aspect. She would have to be careful. She would have to keep to herself.
"I'm not home often," the uncle said. "The driver will take you to buy your necessaries and the groceries you may need. He will drive you to and from the bus stop, which will take you to school. You will hardly see me."
She said a quiet thank you, because silence would have been worse. He looked at her for a long moment and said,
"My mother made me sleep in her closet as well. You must try to sleep in your bed."
"I will,"
she whispered. He closed the door, and she listened to him walking, unlocking, opening, shutting, relocking a series of doors. She kept listening to the silent house until the silence filled her, and she slept again. Within the first hour of American school, the boy sitting in front of Aurélie turned around. He whispered,
"Why is 6 afraid of 7? Because 7, 8, 9.
She didn't understand.
"You're stupid," he said.
Lunch, an incomprehensible slab of bread and cheese, milk that smelled rotten. She sat on the playground trying to be as small as possible, though she was very big for her age. The boy with the joke came by with 3 other boys.
"Aurélie! Aurélie!"
they cried, and stuck their tongues in one cheek, mimed a penis going in and out with their hands. This she understood. She went to the teacher, a baby-like worm with sparse white hair who had prided herself on talking to Aurélie all morning in her high school French patois. Aurélie said as slowly as she could that though Aurélie was her given name, nobody called her that in Paris. The city's name made the teacher's face light up.
"Non?"
she said.
"Et qu'est-ce que c'est le nom que vous préférez?"
Aurélie thought. There was a girl in the form above her at school in Paris, a short, strong, and wry girl with flowing black hair. She was mysterious, cool. The one all the other girls courted with berlingot and bande dessinée. When she was angry, words came whip-like to her lips. She used her power sparingly. Mathilde was her name.
"Mathilde,"
Aurélie said.
"Mathilde,"
the teacher said.
"Bon."
Like that, all at once, Mathilde grew up over Aurélie's skin. She felt the other girl's stillness come over her, her cool eye, her quickness. When the boy in front of her turned around to mime a blowjob, she darted her hand out and pinched his tongue hard through his cheek, and he yelped, and tears rose to his eyes, and the teacher turned to find Mathilde sitting calmly. The boy was punished for making noise. She watched as, over the course of the hour, twin purple grapes developed on his cheek. She wanted to suck them. At a party once, in the happy underground years in Greenwich Village, when Lotto and she had been so desperately poor, holes in her socks, lunches of sunshine and water, their Christmas lights making a chain of lemons on the walls, rot-gut vodka mixed with juice, she was flipping through the CDs when she heard someone shout out, "Aurélie!" And she was immediately 11 again, desperate, lonely, confused. She spun around. But it was her husband, full bore.
"Didn't know it was a suppository, so he took it orally."
Friends hooted. Girls danced by with cups in their hands. Mathilde went into the bedroom, feeling robotic, past the three engrossed bodies on the bed without looking. She hoped when they were done they'd change the duvet cover. She went into the closet that stank of cedar blocks and the dust of her own skin. She nestled among her shoes, fell asleep, woke to Lotto hours later opening the door and laughing and picking her up tenderly and putting her into bed. She was glad of the mattress stripped of its sheets, she and her husband alone at last, his hot, avid hand on her neck, her upper thigh. "Yes," she said. She didn't want to, really, but it didn't matter. The weight of his body was pressing her into the present. Mathilde was slowly coming back. And Aurélie, that sad, lost girl, vanished again. Aurélie was meek and mild. Mathilde boiled underneath a placid skin. Once, she was playing tetherball, and a boy in her class was winning, and she deliberately hit the ball so hard into his face that he was knocked down, and his head bounced on the asphalt, and he had a concussion. Once, she heard her name from a pocket of girls who then laughed. She waited. At lunch a week later, she sat next to the most popular of those girls, and waited until she took a big bite of her sandwich, and underneath the table, stabbed her fork into the girl's thigh. The girl spat out the bite before screaming, and Mathilde had had time to hide the fork under a table buttress. She blinked her huge eyes at the teacher, and was believed. The other children regarded her now with fear in their faces. Mathilde floated through her days coolly, as if she were in the clouds, watching dispassionately down. Her uncle's in Pennsylvania was only a place to stay, chill and dim, not a home. She imagined for herself a separate life, a chaotic mess with six sisters, loud pop on the radio, nail polish stink and bobby pins on the vanity. Game nights with popcorn and screaming fights. Voice from the other bed in the night. The sole welcome in her uncle's house was the warm buzz of the television. She mocked a soap opera, The Stars in Your Eyes, in the characters' own voices, until she lost her accent. Her uncle was never home. Did she burn to see what was behind those locked doors? She did, but she didn't pick the locks. Already a miracle of self-possession! On Sundays, the driver took her to the grocery store, and if she was fast and they still had time, he'd drive her to a little park near a river to feed sheets of white bread to the ducks. Her loneliness was so huge it took the form of the upstairs hallway, dark and lined with locked doors. Once even, swimming in the river, a leech attached to her inner thigh, so close to what mattered that it thrilled her, and she left it there, thought of it throughout her days, her invisible friend. When it fell off in the shower and she accidentally stepped on it, she wept. To stay away from the house, she joined the time-intensive clubs at school that didn't require her to speak. She swam and joined the chess team and learned the flute for the band, a thoroughly demeaning instrument, she felt, but easy to master. In the height of her happiness many years later, she would think of that solitary little girl, face downturned like a demure fucking bellflower, while inside there was the maelstrom. She'd want to smack that kid hard, or pick her up in her arms and cover her eyes and run somewhere safe with her. Instead, her uncle adopted her when she was 12. She wasn't aware he was going to until the day before the court hearing. The driver told her. He'd gained so much weight over the year that his stomach had grown a little stomach. When he was lifting her groceries to the trunk, she had the urge to bury her face in the many pillows of him.
"Adopted? Isn't that nice?" the driver said. "Now you needn't worry, mamselle, about having to go somewhere else. You belong here now."
When he saw her expression, he touched her. Was it the first time he'd touched her? On the crown of the head,
and said,
"Oh, girl pie, don't take it so hard."
On the ride home, her silence was like the fields they were passing, ice-racked, weary with blackbirds. Inside the car, the driver said,
"I'm supposed to call you Miss Yoder now."
"Yoder?" she said. "But that wasn't my grandmother's name." The driver's eyes in the rear view grew merry.
"They say your uncle changed his name to the first thing he saw when he got the filly. Reading Terminal Market it was. Yoder's Pies."
Then a flash of alarm in his face, and he said,
"You won't tell I said so."
"Who would I tell? I don't talk to anybody but you," she said.
"Sweet thing," he said. "You break my heart. You do."
The day Mathilde turned 13, she found one door downstairs unlocked and open a crack. Her uncle must have left it for her just so. For a moment, the hunger in her tipped over, and she couldn't suppress her curiosity. She entered. It was a library, with leather couches and Tiffany lights, and save for a glass cabinet that held what Mathilde would later find out to be antique Japanese erotica, she could reach all of the books in the room without stretching. They were strange things, ancient hardcovers that seemed, despite their similar deckled edges and cloth bindings, to be gathered randomly. In her sophisticated years, she'd understand that these were books sold by the yard, mostly for decorative purposes. But in those bad years, in her early teens, they were volleys from a kinder Victorian world. She read them all. She was so versed in Ian McLaren and Anthony Hope, Booth Tarkington and Winston Churchill, the American, Mary Augusta Ward, and Frances Hodgson Burnett, that the sentences in her English papers became ever more ornate and elaborate. American education being what it is, her teachers took her Rococo sentences to be evidence of a prodigious facility with language that she didn't actually have. She won all the English awards her last year in middle school. She won them all in high school also. On her 13th birthday, she thought, closing the library door behind her, that at this rate she would know what was in every room of the house by the time she was 30. Except that, 1 month later, her uncle left a door unlocked unintentionally. She wasn't supposed to be home. She had walked back from school because of the half-day called. There was a brutal snowstorm on the horizon, and the chauffeur couldn't be reached on the office phone, and she missed the bus anyway. She walked in the freezing cold, her bare knees numbed after 5 minutes. She pushed the last 2 miles in a sideways wind with her fingers making blinders to keep the snow out. When she came back to the stone house, she had to crouch on the doorstep with her hands under her bra to warm them enough to work the key. She heard voices inside, at the end of the hall, where the library was. She took off her shoes, feet blocks of ice, and crept to the kitchen, where there were half-eaten sandwiches on the counter. A bag of chips splayed its barbecue guts. Someone's cigarette burned in a teacup, quarter inch of ash. In the windows, the storm was almost black. She tried to go toward the staircase noiselessly, but stopped short. Under the stairway there was a small room, and she'd never seen the door open until now. She heard footsteps and stepped inside, quietly shutting the door. The overhead light was on. She flicked it off. She crouched behind a strange statue of a horse head and breathed into her hand. The footsteps passed. There were loud male voices and more steps. In the dark, her warming skin was full of chewing ants. The great front door slammed, and she waited and waited, but she could feel that the house was empty and that she was alone. She turned the light on and saw what she'd only vaguely seen before. Along the wall, there were canvases with their faces turned away and little pieces of statuary. She picked up a painted board. It was heavy, solid. She turned it around and almost dropped it. Never in her life had she seen a more perfect thing. At the bottom, in the foreground, there was a curvy white horse with a man in blue robes riding it, the fabric so lush she touched it to make sure it wasn't real. Behind him were other men, other horses, a jagged rock face. Up against the blue sky was a soft, pale city so perfect it seemed made of bones. She memorized it. At last she put it back down and took off her sweater to wipe up the snow melt that had dripped onto the floor from her hair and clothes. She closed the door behind her and felt a keen loss when she heard the lock fall into place. She went up the stairs and lay in the dark with her eyes closed to re-see the panel. When the chauffeur came in, calling worriedly for her, she reached out her window, gathered two handfuls of snow, put both on her hair, and ran to the kitchen.
"Oh, girl,"
he said, sitting heavily down.
"I thought we lost you in that storm."
She didn't mind that his concern had been for both of them, that if he had indeed lost her, he would have been in danger himself.
"I got in a few minutes ago," she said, still shivering,
and he took her hand and felt how cold it was, and made her sit, and made cocoa from scratch, then chocolate chip cookies, too. For her 14th birthday, Mathilde's uncle took her out to dinner. In 3 years, they had never shared a meal. She'd opened her bedroom door to see the red dress he'd laid on her bed like a skinny girl thrown backward. Beside it was her first pair of high heels, 3 inches tall and black. She dressed slowly. The restaurant was warm, a converted farmhouse not unlike her uncle's, but with a fire burning in the hearth. Her uncle looked ill in the golden light, as if his skin were candle tallow, half melted. She steeled herself to look at him while he ordered for both of them. Caesar salad, steak tartare with a quail's egg atop, followed by filet mignon, side of roasted potatoes and asparagus, Côte du Rhône. Mathilde had been a vegetarian since she saw an exposé on television about industrial husbandry, cows hung on hooks and flayed alive, chickens squeezed into cages that broke their legs and living out their days caked in their own shit. When the salads came, the uncle twirled a brown anchovy on his fork and congratulated her, in French, for being so poised and self-sufficient. He swallowed without chewing. Like a shark, she knew from television.
"I have no choice. I've been left entirely alone," Mathilde said. She hated herself for allowing her mouth to twitch and betray her.
He put his fork down and looked at her.
"Oh, please, Aurélie. You weren't beaten. You weren't starved. You go to school and the dentist and the doctor. I had none of those things. You are being melodramatic. This isn't Oliver Twist. You are not some child in a coal mine. I have been kind to you."
"Blacking factory. Dickens worked in a blacking factory," she said.
She switched to English.
"No, I wouldn't say you have never been unkind."
He sensed the insult better than he understood it.
"No matter. I am all you ever would have had. Diables, they called you. I must say I have seen no evidence of your devil, to my disappointment. Either it's not there, or you have learned to dissimulate as all good devils do."
"Perhaps living in fear can drive all devils out of a person," she said. "Exorcism by terror."
She drank her water and poured wine to the top of the glass and drank it down.
"You have witnessed nothing you should fear," he said.
He leaned forward and smiled.
"I could change that, if you prefer."
For a moment, she stopped breathing. Perhaps it was the wine that made her vision swim.
"No, thank you," she said.
"You are welcome," he said.
He finished the salad, wiped his mouth, and said,
"Nobody has told you that your parents have new babies. New, well, relatively. One is 3, and 1 is 5. Little boys. Your brothers, I suppose. I'd show you the photo my sister sent, but I seem to have lost it.
Strange how things are associated with their particular pains. Caesar salad, forever a suffocating sadness. She smiled at a spot above her uncle's head, where the firelight reflected off an antique barometer. It also shined through his pointed ears. She said nothing. He said, when the fillet came,
"You are very tall, skinny, odd-looking, which seems fashionable. You could be a model, perhaps, even put yourself through college."
She drank her water in slow and even sips.
"Ah," he said, "you thought I was going to send you to college, but my obligation ends at 18.
"You could afford it," she said.
"I could," he said, "but I'm interested in watching what you'll do. Struggle forms character. No struggle, no character. Nobody gave me a thing in my life," he said. "Not one thing. I earned it all."
"And look at you now," she said.
He smiled at her, and the resemblance to her grandmother, her long-ago mother, absent all warmth, made her skin prickle.
"Be careful," he said.
The untouched meat on her plate became fuzzy and slowly cleared.
"Why do you hate me?" she said.
"Oh, child, I have no feelings about you whatsoever," he said.
This was the kindest thing he would ever say to her. He slurped down a panna cotta. There was cream in the folds of his mouth. The check arrived, and a man came up to her uncle and shook his hand, murmuring in his ear, and Mathilde gratefully turned away because, from the corner of her eye, she caught a slight movement in the doorway. A white cat had inserted its head into the room and was pulling its taut body on its forepaws, staring fixedly into the woodpile. Tiny tiger, hunting. For some time she was lulled by the cat's immobility, only the tiny twitch at the end of the tail to signal life, and then, without warning, the cat leapt. When it turned, a soft, boneless, gray thing hung in its mouth. A field mouse, Mathilde thought. The cat trotted off, its tail jaunty with pride. When she turned back to her uncle and his friend, they were looking at her, amused.
"Dimitri just said that you are the cat. The cat is you," the uncle said.
No, she had always hated cats. They seemed so full of rage. She put her napkin on the table and smiled with all her teeth. 9. The only one who returned and returned and returned was Rachel. Rachel made soup and focaccia, which Mathilde fed to the dog. Rachel returned alone, with Elizabeth, with the children, who ran in the fields with God until the dog collapsed, and then combed all the tufts and brambles out of her fur and left her lax and panting for hours afterward.
"I don't want to see you," Mathilde shouted at Rachel when she came alone one morning with cheese danishes and fresh juice. "Go away!"
"Abuse me all you want," Rachel said. She put the pastries down on the mat and stood again, fierce in the dim morning light. That god-awful tattoo up her arm, all spiderweb and mermaid and a little turnip, some sort of bondage fantasia, or at the very least a mixed metaphor. The family had a talent for figurative knots. Rachel said,
"I won't go away. I'll come back again and again and again until you're well." "I'm warning you," Mathilde said through the glass door. "I'm the worst person you know."
"That is untrue," Rachel said. "You are one of the kindest, most generous people I've ever met. You're my sister, and I love you."
"Ha! You don't know me," Mathilde said.
"But I do," Rachel said. She laughed, and though all her life Mathilde had felt a sort of sorrow that Rachel was nothing like her brother, so great and shining, now she saw Lotto in his little sister's face, the same semi-dimple in the cheek, the strong teeth. Mathilde shut her eyes and locked the door. Even still, with her endless, nervous energy, Rachel came back, and she came back, and she came back. She'd fallen asleep in the pool house. 6 months after Lotto died, grim heat of August, their old friend Samuel had come that morning to remonstrate, nostrils flaring, and she'd waited him out in the pool house while he circled the house, bellowing her name. Oh, little Samuel, she thought, listening. Kind son of a corrupt senator father. It had become a joke. Unbelievable, the trials of Samuel, the DUIs, the divorces, the cancer, the house he'd burned down in his 30s. The racist a year ago who'd found Sam walking home at night from a movie and beat him to concussion. Not the smartest or the bravest, but he'd been born with preternatural confidence. Job was just a whiner compared with him. Samuel was gone when she woke. Her skin was glazed in sweat. Her mouth was sandpaper and tar, and she thought of the berries waiting on the countertop for her, the pie she could already taste. Butter, zest, essence of summer, salt. She heard another car turn onto the gravel. God was barking in the kitchen. She came across the too bright grass and into the house and up the stairs to see from her bedroom who had arrived. Even the tiger lilies Mathilde had cut for herself seemed to be sweating. A young person stepped out of an inexpensive little car, some kind of Hyundai or Kia. Rental. City boy. Boy, well, 30 or thereabouts. Alone so long, Mathilde had taken to thinking of herself as wizened, ancient. To see herself in the mirror was to see the shock of unexpected youth. There was something about this person's loose-limbed walk across the drive that held her. He was medium-sized, dark-haired, handsome, with his long eyelashes and defined jaw. Something whirred in her chest uncomfortably, which she had come to recognize in the past months as a strange chimera of rage and lust. Well, only one way to exercise it. She sniffed her armpits. They'd do. She startled when she saw that the boy was looking up at her in the window as he came up to the door. She had taken to wearing Lotto's white t-shirts and had sweated through this one so it was transparent, her nipples saying a double hello. She pulled on a tunic and descended and opened the door to the boy. God snuffled at his shoes, and he knelt and petted her. When he stood to shake Mathilde's hand, his palm was covered with a fine layer of dog down and was clammy beneath. When he touched her, he burst into tears. Well, she said, another of my husband's mourners, I see. Her husband, patron saint of failed actors. Because it was clear now that this boy was an actor. He had that cocksure carriage, the observant brightness. So many of them had shown up to touch the great man's hem, but there was no hem left, Mathilde having given away or burned nearly everything, save the books and manuscripts. Only Mathilde was left, his homelier husk, the old wifey wife.
I never knew him, but you can say I'm a mourner, I guess,
the boy said, turning away to wipe his face. When he turned back, he was red, embarrassed.
I'm so sorry, he said.
I've made iced tea, Mathilde heard herself say. Wait here in the rocker, and I'll bring some. By the time she came back, the boy had calmed. Sweat curled the hair at his temples. She put on the overhead porch fan and set the tray down on the little table, taking a lemon bar for herself. She'd survived on wine and sugar for months, because, fuck it, she never really got a childhood, and what was grief but an extended tantrum to be salved by sex and candy? The boy man picked up his tea and touched the tray, which she'd gotten in some rag-and-bone shop in London. He touched the Herald and read aloud,
Non sans droit?
He bolted up in his chair, spilling iced tea on his lap, and said,
"Oh my God, that's Shakespeare's family."
"Calm down," she said. "It's Victorian, a fake. He reacted exactly the way you did. He thought we had something that passed through old Willie's hands and almost wet himself."
"For so many years, I dreamt of driving up here,"
the boy said.
"Just to say hello. I dreamt that he'd invite me in, and we'd have a nice dinner and talk and talk. I always knew we'd get along famously, he and I. Lancelot. And me."
"His friends called him Lotto," she said. "I'm Mathilde."
"I know. The dragon wife," he said. "I'm Land."
With extreme slowness, she said, "Did you just call me the dragon wife?"
"Oh, sorry. That's what all the actors in the company called you when I was in Grimoire and One-Eyed King. Revival, not first run. Of course you'd know that, because you protected him. You made sure he was paid on time and kept people away, and you did it all while seeming so nice. I thought it was an honorific, like a joke you were in on."
"No," she said. "I was not in on this particular joke."
"Whoops," he said.
"It's true," Mathilde said after some time.
"I could breathe fire."
She thought of how Lotto, in later years, had been called the lion. With his dander up, he could roar. He looked leonine, too, his corona of white-shot gold, the fine, sharp cheekbones. He'd leap on stage, offended by some actor flubbing his precious lines, and there he'd pace, sleek and swift, with his long, lovely body, growling. He could be deadly, fierce. The name was not inapt. But please, Mathilde knew lions. The male lolled beautifully, lazy in the sun. The female, less lovely by miles, was the one who brought back the kill. The boy was sweating. His blue Oxford shirt was hooped wetly under the arms. He was emitting a smell that was not unpleasant, exactly. It was a clean stink. Funny, she thought, looking over the banks of snapdragons to the river. Her mother had smelled of cold and scales, her father of stone dust and dog. She imagined her husband's mother, whom she had never met, had a whiff of rotting apples, although her stationery had stunk of baby powder and rose perfume. Sally was starch, cedar. Her dead grandmother, sandalwood. Her uncle, Swiss cheese. People told her that she smelled like garlic, like chalk, like nothing at all. Lotto, clean as camphor at his neck and belly, like electrified pennies at the armpit, like chlorine at the groin. She swallowed. Such things, details noticed only on the edges of thought, would not return. "Land," Mathilde said. "Odd name for a guy like you."
"Short for a Roland," the boy said.
Where the August sun had been steaming over the river, a green cloud was forming. It was still terrifically hot, but the birds had stopped singing. A feral cat scooted up the road on swift paws. It would rain soon.
"All right, Roland," Mathilde said, suppressing a sigh. "Sing your song."
Land told her what she already knew. Actor. Had a recurring role on this soap opera, minor, but it paid the bills.
"The stars in your eyes," he said. "Heard of it?"
He looked at her hopefully, then grimaced.
"I see,"
he said.
"Soaps aren't your thing. Mine either. It's hack work, but I got the job as soon as I got to the city. 15 years ago, literally the first audition I walked into. And it's good money, and I can do plays in the summer when we don't film."
He shrugged.
"I'm not a superstar, but I work all the time. That's a kind of success, I guess."
"You don't need to argue for the benefits of a steady gig," she said. She felt reckless, disloyal.
"Lotto never got one when he was an actor. It would have been an immense relief to have some pay coming in all those years.
I worked my ass off, and he made maximum $7,000 a year until he started writing.
Thank God he started writing,
Land said. He told her that every birthday he took the day off to drive out to the beach and read The Springs. Lancelot never got his fair shakes as the genius he was.
He would have agreed, Mathilde said dryly. But I love that about him, that arrogance,
Land said.
I did too, Mathilde said.
The clouds like blackberry jam in the sky, faint double boiler thunder from the north, all the things she could do other than sit here were gathering in the cool shadows of the house behind her, watching through the window. She was nailed to the chair. She liked this boy, liked him enormously, more than anyone she'd met since Lotto died. She could just open her mouth and eat him, he was so sweet. There was something easy about him, a gentleness she'd always loved in manly men.
To tell you the truth, I wanted to meet you almost as much as I wanted to meet him,
Land said. Why? She said. She was blushing. Flirting? It wasn't impossible.
You're the untold story, he said. The mystery.
What mystery? She said.
The woman he chose to spend his life with,
Land said.
He's easy to know. There are billions of interviews, and his plays come from him and give you a little window in. But you're back in the shadows, hiding there. You're the interesting one.
It took a very long moment as they sat there on the porch, sweating in silence, for Mathilde to say to the boy, I am not the interesting one. She knew she was the interesting one.
You're a bad liar, he said.
She looked at him and imagined him in bed, those lovely fingers with the buffed nail beds, the neck with the visible cords, the strong jaw, that good body clear under his clothes, that sensitive face, and knew he'd be very good at fucking.
Let's go inside, she said, and stood.
He blinked, startled. Then he stood and opened the door for her, following her in. He was attentive, soft where he should be, strong under her arms. But there was something off. It wasn't that she was so much older than he was. She estimated 10 years, 15 max, and it wasn't that she didn't know him, really. She hadn't really known anybody she'd taken to bed with her the past 6 months. The absence of story was what she liked about them. But they were in the bathroom, and she was watching his high-boned face behind her, his hand gripping her short hair, the other on her shoulder, and though it felt marvelous, she couldn't focus.
I can't hold out any longer, he said.
He was shining with sweat. Don't, she said, and he was a gentleman, and pulled out and groaned, and there was a heat on her back just above the coccyx. Nice, she said. Super sexy porn move. He laughed and dabbed her off with a warm washcloth. In the window, the bushes by the river were being flattened by wind and the hard, sparse rain that had begun to fall.
Sorry, he said. I didn't know what else to do. Didn't want to, you know, get you in the family way.
She stood and stretched her arms above her head. Don't worry, she said. I'm old.
You are not, he said.
Well, I'm barren, she said. She didn't say by choice. He nodded and went a little inward, then said suddenly,
Is that why you didn't have any kids?
Then he blushed and crossed his arms over his chest and said,
I'm so sorry. That was rude. I was just wondering why you and he didn't have kids, I mean.
That's why, she said.
Something medical?
He said.
I'm prying. Don't answer if it's annoying.
I was sterilized when I was younger. His silence was pointed, and she said, He didn't know. He thought I was just plain barren. It made him feel noble to suffer in silence. Why was she telling this boy all of this? Because there were no stakes. Lotto was gone. The secret would hurt nobody. Plus, she liked the boy, wanted to give him something. The previous pilgrims had carried off almost everything else. She suspected he had ulterior motives, an article, a book, an exposé at some point. If he wrote about the sex, the rainstorm, she would come off as desperate or sad or desperately sad. It was all accurate. So be it.
But why wouldn't you tell him?
He said. Oh, the puppy. He sounded wounded on her husband's behalf.
Because nobody needs my genes in the world, she said.
Land said,
but his genes. I mean, the kid might have been a genius, too.
Mathilde pulled on the bathrobe and swept her hand through her short hair. She looked at herself in the mirror and admired the rosy flush. The rain pounded harder on the roof. She liked the sound, the sense of coziness of the gray and falling day outside.
Lotto would have been a terrific father, she said. But the kids of geniuses are never geniuses.
True, Land said. She touched his face and he flinched, then leaned forward to rest his cheek in her hand. Little pet, she thought.
I want to make you dinner, she said. I'd love dinner, he said.
And then I want you to fuck me again, she said.
I'd love to fuck you again,
he said, laughing. At dawn, when she woke, the house had gone quiet, and she knew that Land had left. A shame. I could have kept him around for a little while, she thought. Used him as a pool boy, as human cardio machine. God grumbled at the door, having been banished. When Mathilde went out, the dog came in and flounced herself down on the bed. In the kitchen, there was a fruit salad macerating in its juices. He'd made a pot of coffee, which was lukewarm now. In the blue bowl with the slowly ripening green tomatoes from the garden, the sweet boy had left a note in an envelope. Mathilde would leave it there for weeks before she opened it. Seeing it there, the white and the red in the blue, made her feel for the first time since her husband left her as if she had kind and gentle company in the house with her. Something hot in her began to cool, and, in cooling, began to anneal. Make me happy, Frankenstein's monster pleaded with its maker, and I shall again be virtuous.
10. Mathilde was 16. She woke to find her uncle swaying over her. She had learned to sleep in a bed. He was saying,
Aurélie, this is important. Do not go downstairs.
And in the hollow after his words, she could hear men's voices below, shouting, music. His face was expressionless, but the color in his cheeks was high. Without anyone's saying a thing, she'd begun to understand that her uncle was some kind of manager in a bad organization. He was often in Philadelphia. He hissed orders into a huge, clunky, early version of a mobile phone, was inexplicably gone for weeks, and came back, if not tan, then tanner. Still apparent in him, the tiny boy, mewling in cold and hunger. It's less delicious, this badness bred from survival. He left, and she lay frozen for some time. The shouting now did not seem so joyous. She heard anger, fear. When she could move, she pulled the couch out from where it rested against the wall and brought the duvet and pillow behind it, and in that place, the exact shape of her body, she fell asleep swiftly, as if held there. Nobody, as far as she knew, had come to her room in the night. Still, the air felt disturbed, as if she'd narrowly avoided something. She crept like a mouse through her teenaged years, flute and swimming and books, all the wordless arts. She made herself so small her uncle would forget her. Her senior year, she opened the letter telling her she'd been accepted to the one school she'd applied to, early, for no other reason than that she'd loved the oddball essay questions in the application.
how such small things can decide one's fate. But the whistling conflagration of joy had ebbed to embers days later, when she understood she couldn't pay. If she couldn't pay, she couldn't go. Simple as that.